This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And all month, we're playing the best commencement speeches we've come across over the last two decades and longer, and also a couple of the worst, because my goodness, they can be entertaining too, really bad speeches. I mean, if you don't have to sit through them. Hey, Jesse, what's the circumstance of this song? Why are we listening to it?
Well, it was first written for the coronation of King Edward VII and Queen Alexandria in 1902. Dedicated by special permission to His Most Gracious Majesty, King Edward VII. But the coronation was postponed due to the king falling sick. So the performance was not until the 2nd of October, 1902, at the Sheffield Festival by the Sheffield Choir.
So that's why we listen to this song. It makes no sense.
No, there's no reason it's been dedicated for graduation.
But it's the song, and that's that.
Yeah.
And we're not critics here, by the way. We really don't like critics. So if you notice, we don't generally dump on stuff here. But
we're critical of critics.
We're critical of critics, exactly. And I think we can unify around that. By the way, great British accent, Jesse. So today, the commencement speech we care about is given by Leanne Toohey at Christian Brothers University. And that's a private Catholic university, the oldest university in Memphis, Tennessee. And you know Leanne Toohey because Sandra Bullock played her and got an Oscar for playing her in the movie The Blind Side. And Leanne Toohey's family became involved in the life of a young black man who was largely abandoned as a child, eventually adopted the young man. And this young man, Michael Orr, goes on to play football in the NFL. In fact, he was a first-round draft choice of the Baltimore Ravens in 2009 and currently plays for the Carolina Panthers. And by the way, we're broadcasting from Oxford, Mississippi, home of Ole Miss, where Michael Orr played, where Leanne Toohey went to college, and where Sean Toohey, her husband, was a standout rock star point guard and a superb athlete. Then went on into the franchising business, started to own one, then two, and now own who knows how many, 60, 70, 80, a whole bunch. And they did this remarkable thing, this remarkable act of love for a stranger, and changed his life and so many others. Let's take a listen to how Leanne addressed these graduates back in 2010.
But we firmly believe that God is in control of the story in our lives right now. A lot of things we've learned from this, value is one of them. What do those words mean? You go into an office, you interview for a job, you're going to want someone to value. You're going to hope that they look at you and think that you have worth and that you have value, something that can contribute to the next level of your life, whatever that may be. And then you look at people and you value them. It's a two-way street. Now, you'll leave here today. Everyone in this auditorium will leave here today, and before the day ends, you will look at someone this day and you will put value on them. Whether it's someone you pass in the parking lot, at the grocery store tonight, the guy pumping gas next to you, wherever you may be, in your mind, you go, You size up somebody. We all do it. If you say you don't, you're lying. We all do it. Let me tell you about my son, Michael Orr. Finest young man you'll ever meet. Immensely intelligent, extremely athletic, the best tackle in the NFL. Said from a mother's perspective. Society deemed him valueless. My son got off of a bus every day at Poplar and Ridgeway and walked to school. I'm going to tell you that 30 or 40,000 cars a day passed him. There was not a soul in this world that cared whether that young man lived or died. If he had fallen dead right there on the street, no one would have known whom to contact. He wasn't using the correct last name. He wasn't sure when his birthday was. Things that you take for granted and instill in your kids every day. Society deemed Michael Orr valueless. You take him into a home, and you love him, and you give him hope, and you give him opportunity. And people, it will change a life. I've lived it. I have lived it. This young man was so close to falling through the cracks that it will rock your world when you really think about the opportunity that could have been lost with this young man's life. And through, just some everyday circumstances, our paths cross. In our house, we call it a miracle. As I told this distinguished group behind me earlier, childbirth is truly easier to explain than how we got to where we are with Michael. It has been God-driven. He has value, and no one saw it.
Value, the word that Leanne uses, it has a lot more meaning after hearing her explain it. Let's rejoin Leanne.
How many Michael Orrs are out there? I can tell you, folks, that there's Michael Orrs in every city in the United States of America. We firmly believe in the Tuohy household that the kid that knows the cure for cancer is walking around inner city Memphis, Tennessee, and all he needs is a chance. All he needs is a chance. And I'm not telling you, I'm not challenging you to go out and adopt a 6'6", 350-pound black kid. It is not for everybody. They eat a lot. Thank goodness we're in the Taco Bell business. You can do something, and you can make a difference. You guys sit here, you think, I'm in college. What can I do? You can do something. Pick whatever it is that you choose to do. Just do it well. There are all kind of opportunities right under your nose. Two words have changed our life. Turn around. Turn around. Get off the beaten path. Get off the golf course. Get out of your biology class. Whatever it may be, it could be right under your nose, the person that needs the help.
Inspiring words. Commencement addresses all month, this month. This is Lee Habib. That was Leanne Tuohy. The Blind Side by Michael Lewis. And then the movie, Sandra Bullock played her. And what a performance and what a life and what a thing to do. This is Our American Stories. We'll be back after these messages. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And each week, we like to cover sports, what's been going on. And we do it every week with the USA Today team over at For the Win. And joining us, as always, Nate Scott. Nate, thanks for joining us, as always.
Of course, Lee. Happy to be here.
Hey, Nate, I want to throw a little sound at you. We know it's the most exciting 2 minutes in sports. Even people who don't like horse racing tune in for the Kentucky Derby and pretend they're there, and some might even toss down a mint julep. But let's listen to the final call.
And they're into the stretch, and it's Nyquist. Nyquist has taken the lead on the outside. Gunrunner, second at the rail. 5 lengths back to Destin in third. And they come to the final furlong. Exaggerator is closing in. Nyquist to catch with a 16th to go. Gunrunner, Exaggerator on the outside. Nyquist and Exaggerator. They're coming to the line together. And Nyquist is still unbeaten. He has won the Kentucky Derby.
Pretty extraordinary. What were you thinking before this race started, Nate? What was the sentiment over there at USA Today and the team over there at For the Win going into the race?
You know, coming in, we basically, you know, we it's hard to tell with horses just with the hype, but with Nyquist, anytime a horse comes into the Kentucky Derby undefeated, you have to take him seriously. For us, the big thing was, you know, we felt like the nation kind of had a collective hangover after American Pharoah won the Triple Crown last year, and it feels like it just happened, and now we have to get excited about another horse. But the more I read about Nyquist, the more I thought, oh, man, this horse might actually do something. And to see it win the race like that, to hold off late charge in a race that got going so fast, made me start thinking, oh, man, this horse might be for real.
Well, what was remarkable is the trip it got. I mean, we talk a lot about horse racing here on the show. I think I may be one of the only hosts in America who on December 26th decided to take that day off. I mean, I took Christmas off to fly my little girl out to the opening meet at Santa Anita from Memphis. So we particularly like horse racing here. But a trip in horse racing is just getting a perfect run around the track and not getting caught up in traffic, not getting bumped. And this horse just made it look easy, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And you speak to, you know, that's the always the thing that kind of comes into play here is you never know with races like this. Nyquist did look like the horse to beat coming in, but things happen in races. Injuries happen. You know, people get glommed up. Jockeys might not have perfect rides, but Nyquist looked real good. He's got to be the favorite moving forward. And my colleague Chris Gorman wrote, you know, it seems incredible that just a year after American Pharoah, we could be talking about this, but this is a type of horse that could do the Triple Crown.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, obviously Pimlico's next, and that's the Preakness at Pimlico. And that's more the speed race. And then, of course, you wait another 3 weeks. And in June, we got that endurance race, the mile and a half around the track at Belmont. Let's shift gears, Nate. The NFL draft is now behind us. But I wanted to dig into a story because it's pretty remarkable how many people tune in now to the draft and to watch it. But this was quite a lift and quite a sale back when it was first broadcast in 1980, and we love For the Win. And by the way, that's ftw.usatoday.com, folks. If you want to get the work and the storytelling that Nate and his team do over there, this is one of those stories that I was just really touched by. This was a crazy idea in 1980, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, ESPN kind of came along and they were looking for programming, sort of anything they could get their hands on, and they pitched the idea to the NFL that, hey, we want to broadcast the draft. Now, if you think back then, the NFL draft happened on a Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock in some ballroom in some hotel somewhere. Right. You know, this wasn't exactly riveting viewing. It was more like you know, people reading off names off a spreadsheet, basically. ESPN had the vision, though. They said, you know what, we want to make this into something that people care about. This is something we think people care about. And so they started broadcasting it, and from there, you know, things just started rolling, and now it's, you know, one of the most popular televised events of the sporting year.
Yep. I, you know, in your printed piece, you wrote this, Chris Berman, who's been with ESPN, what, forever?
Yeah.
Said that what the thought was then is to Pete Rozelle, who was then commissioner, it sounded like reading names from the phone book. And he said, who's going to watch that? Now we know that lots of people want to watch that. A whole country does.
Exactly. And I mean, Berman started out when they first did it. He was in a bar across the street trying to talk to people. The feed was dying. He was trying to get fans' reactions. No one even knew what was going on.
Right.
And it started as this kind of Mickey Mouse operation, and now to see what it is, it just shows that, you know, if you think people are interested in something, the production values and everything will follow. But if you think something is newsworthy and you make it work, then the rest is history, I guess.
Well, it's such a great promotional. I've always admired the movie industry because they turn the Oscars into not only a promotion for the business, but the American people tune in and they sell advertising and they make money on the promotion of the movie industry.
Yep.
Fascinating, and nice work if you can get it. And then I think this is something the sports industry has learned too.
And I think with sports, you know, that's something we're still learning, and that people, you know, it's not just about the finished product. It's not just about the game. People care about the business behind it, how teams are made, salary caps. People really do care about the business of sports, and the NFL draft, I think, was one of the first times people really understood that.
You know, when you get fantasy football leagues and you get all this other stuff, and it's not just the business of sports, Nate, I think what was fascinating about watching the Kentucky Derby is that they've learned not only the business of sports is interesting, but the story of the people behind the story of the sport is equally compelling. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think people care about the process. And with, you know, watching horses run around a ring, if you don't know anything about the people behind it, the horses themselves, it's just meaningless. It's an animal running in a circle. When you start to learn about Bob Baffert and you start to learn about Nyquist, this horse, how he got his name from one of the Detroit Red Wings that the owner's like, you know, that's the stuff that creates narrative. That's the stuff that creates an emotional connection. And then when Nyquist crosses the finish line, there's a feeling, there's an emotional resonance as opposed to just seeing a horse run really fast.
You bet. And by the way, when you said animal running around in a circle, I almost took offense because you were describing my dating life for my mid-20s and my early 40s. Look, a couple other quick questions, Nate. The NBA, it's cooking up. It's heating up. Steph Curry still not playing. Warriors are up 2-1. What is it looking like with Curry? What's the update? Americans are now riveted and staring at this guy's ankle. I know he's working out a little bit, his knee. What's going on with Steph?
Steph has a knee sprain right now. What the doctors basically say is it can't get a lot worse, but it is painful. And the Warriors don't want to risk aggravating that pain. And so basically right now they're kind of holding serve and seeing how well this team can play without him. Curry was, reports came out today that he'll be named MVP consecutive years. That just broke today. So he's going to be your NBA MVP. He is the best player in the league, but the thing about the Warriors is there's so much depth. There's so much talent on that team. Sean Livingston has come in right in, filled in as the backup point guard. They don't need to rush him back. They can take their time. They can see how this team does without him. And then, you know, they're going to need him for either the Spurs or the Thunder in the next round. So I think they're already looking ahead a little bit, though they'd never admit that.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of think it may be the best thing that happened to the team if indeed he becomes healthy. Because, my goodness, all these other players get to shine in ways, not that they didn't shine before, Nate, but they get to carry the team. And that feels good for these guys to be able to do that and get their due.
Absolutely. And I mean, you looked at it last year in the NBA Finals. Curry struggled a little bit, and Andre Iguodala stepped up and was the Finals MVP. Not everyone remembers that, but that's what's so amazing about this Warriors team is they've got about eight different guys who can step up on any given night. And if you take away one of their options, someone else is going to step up, which is why I'm still picking them to be NBA champions, even though the Cavaliers look great.
Yeah, I got to say, a Cavs-Golden State Warriors final, I think, would draw some big buzz, even though, again, they're from two not big, big markets, not New York and L.A. or even Chicago or Dallas. It'd be great. Hey, 1 minute, Nate. You guys wrote this week about how a PGA golfer got disqualified from a tournament for something a bit unusual. Talk about that.
Yeah, Zach Blair missed a short putt on a hole at the Wells Fargo Championship. It was a birdie putt on number 5. He missed it. He was frustrated, and he slammed his putter against his head and bent it. That wouldn't be a big deal, except he went then and knocked in the putt. On the next hole, he noticed that his club was bent. And there's a PGA rule that you cannot augment your clubs in the course of a round. I don't know why bending a putter would help him, but he reported it to the rules official. And that was it. He was disqualified.
Oh, no. That's the thing about golf. Sometimes their rules are just off the edge. They're gone. They're crazy. Nate, as always, thank you so much for joining us. Nate Scott for the win. And that's FTW.USAtoday.com. And we'll start in the next week or so to have their best video posted on our OurAmericanNetwork.org website. Nate, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Link.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, Albert Finney was born. I think one of those actors everybody knows but doesn't know. 4 Oscar nominations, 4, which puts him in very heady territory. You're listening to the Bourne Identity soundtrack. And Finney was in the Bourne Ultimatum in 2007, Skyfall in 2012. That's where you sort of know him from. Nominated for Oscars in Aaron Brockovich. He was that. He was the lawyer who was the boss of Julia Roberts.
I think most people have seen Annie, too.
Annie, exactly.
Daddy Warbucks.
And Daddy Warbucks.
Yeah, as Annie.
Tom Jones, he got an Oscar nomination for that. Murder on the Orient Express in 74. And The Dresser, he won an Oscar nomination in 1983. And Laurence Olivier called him the greatest actor of his generation. And my goodness, that's like Michael Jordan saying you're the best basketball player of your generation. That's scary. And in his generation were lightweights like Michael Caine, Peter O'Toole, and Sean Connery. Finney grew up in 1936. He was born in Salford, Manchester, England. Working class household. So many of these guys. Finney studied at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, like so many before him. And, of course, the Royal Shakespeare Company, where these guys really learn how to really act with great material in rep. His strong presence under the lights earned him notoriety as a stage actor, but it was his work in the 1960 film The Entertainer that launched his career on the big screen. And check that movie out, and check out Laurence Olivier's work in that. It's scary. And then watch Olivier and Richard III. That's even scarier. In a 1960 interview, a 24-year-old Albert Finney described his craft and why it's important for him that his audience doesn't believe that a character he plays has anything to do with who he really is as a person.
The craft side of acting, I think I hate about the sort of, you know, the myths of the cinema and all that, is that the image built up on the screen of actors and their off-screen personalities and saying this is them, you know, and that, I mean, a thing I hate, I mean, and this has happened to me already. The people have seen my performance in Saturday Night, and they think that that's me. You know, they say, oh, that's Albert Finney, and that is his personality. You know, and I feel very strongly that one's audience should realize that one is presenting them with a sort of, it's like a potter, you know, that one in a way is showing, illustrating the way you make the pottery. You're showing them, and you're revealing it to them through your craft as well as through your emotions, all that, but the marriage of instinct and emotions and the spiritual and, you know, and the physical makes it a craft. And I think that is a very important, to me, that's very important.
And it always was through his whole life. It wasn't the fame he wanted. It was the work and the challenge of the work. In that same interview from 1960, Finney shares an insight about the dangers of overexposure as an actor.
Well, I also feel strongly about actors being committed too much with their commitments, a completely unknown quantity. I think it's very bad. Because I'm very young, I'm 24, you know, and I feel that if I'd signed up for 5 years for big international pictures, that one, if one is a success in the first, I think that one becomes an investment, and the amount of, after that, in your next picture, I think that the people who own you, you're sort of like a racehorse, you know, and the people who own you try to make sure that you're still sellable, and they can confine your acting in order to reproduce what they thought was successful about the first film.
By the way, Finney famously turned down director David Lean's offer to have him play Sir Lawrence of Arabia, and his colleague at school at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, Peter O'Toole, got it, and it was a game changer. Finney earned his first Oscar nomination for his role in the film Tom Jones, and that was 63. It wouldn't be his last, as we explained. Over the course of his career, Finney would be nominated those 4 times, but would never attend a ceremony in Los Angeles. My goodness, how many actors do that, huh? Here's what he said. Not my cup of tea. You are not allowed to smoke or drink during the Oscars. Which can go on for 6 hours. And that wouldn't appeal to me in the slightest. Wow. What a guy. And of course, he's joking. It's just not his thing. The red carpet, the pomp, the circumstances. He's just not into it. Finney never won that Oscar, by the way. Though, his performance in The Gathering Storm won him an Emmy. And I think it's what I'll remember most from this remarkable talent. Go rent this movie. Go to Netflix and get this movie. And it is a spectacular movie. I want to play you a clip. And by the way, Vanessa Redgrave is in this too, another pretty good actress. A little nutty on the political side, but what an actress. In this clip from the movie The Gathering Storm, which is all about Churchill's tough choices and tough life that he led, and heroic life he led at a key point in England's history. Here's Churchill, as played by Albert Finney, talking about how painting, of all things, keeps him sane and keeps his, quote, black dogs away.
Are landscapes your speciality?
Well, yes. Less troublesome than portraits. A tree can't tell me that I haven't done it justice.
Don't know how you find time for painting.
Oh, I couldn't do it without it. It keeps me sane. I mean it. This couldn't exist without paints and brushes. The black dog will get me. Are you a warrior?
Yes, I'm afraid I am.
Well, then you should definitely take up painting. It's good for the spirit, calms the nerves. The recognizing and acknowledging of fear as a mark of wisdom. For example, I can't stand too near the edge of a platform when an express train is passing through. Second's action would end everything forever. My doctor says it's a form of melancholia. We call it my black dog. Painting drives it away, as does bricklaying. I'm building a wall. Goes well with writing. 2,000 words, 200 bricks a day.
And then there's a movie everyone knows, and it's Aaron Brockovich. And here's Julia Roberts arguing with her boss, Ed Albert Finney, over her bonus check until she realizes that the, quote, change he made in her bonus check was actually a pretty good one.
I have your bonus check.
Oh, but, yeah.
Now, I want you to be prepared. The figure's not exactly what we discussed.
Why not?
Because after careful consideration, I felt that figure was not appropriate. Although you may not agree, you have to trust my experience and
judgment. You want me to trust you? Do me a favor, Ed. Don't use big words you don't understand.
It's a complicated issue, Aaron. You know,
I did a job. You should reward me accordingly. I want you to know something, Ed. It is not about the number. It is about the way my work is valued in this firm. It's about how, no matter what I do, you're not...
As I was saying, I decided that the figure you proposed was inappropriate. So I increased it. Do they teach beauty queens how to apologize? Because you suck at it.
And done only as Albert Finney, a great character. Great character actor can do. This is Lee Habib on This Day in History, brought to you as always by Hillsdale College. The life of Albert Finney is celebrated. An actor who was not after fame.
Beside me at the wheel, I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you're looking for angry political talk, you'll want to turn the dial. Here at Our American Stories, we tell stories and only stories. And every once in a while about public policy, when it hits the pavement, when it affects you and your story. And that's what we're doing here with the Dodd-Frank regulatory overhaul that became law after the recent economic crisis. Dodd-Frank didn't just regulate Wall Street and the Fortune 500, but Main Street too. And today, we bring you such a story from our field correspondent, Alex Cortez, who spoke to someone who insisted that he be anonymous. Anonymous because he's afraid of retribution from his own government. Here's Alex.
While you're worried about whether your new ride, that 8-cylinder racing stripe Mustang, looks best in red or gunmetal gray, your car dealer is worried about, well, something else.
They would tell the dealerships, hey, you guys don't worry about what the nationality is, but then when they audit you, they say, well, all these names here are this certain nationality, and you've charged them all more than these names here, the Smiths. The Smiths have a lower rate than the X name, and that's a problem. But that's one concern that we have as a dealership. It's like, well, do we not sell to certain names? We're scared now. You know, we're not supposed to worry about nationality. Life is a highway. I
won't ride it all night long. That's Danny, the anonymous general manager of a car dealership who wouldn't let us use his last name. And why is he so worried about your last name? It's an issue that isn't getting much attention in the media, which is why we're bringing it to you.
According to the CFPB, certain lenders that offer auto loans through dealerships are responsible for unlawful discriminatory pricing.
Unlawful discriminatory pricing sounds ominous and illegal. Like something straight out of a past era. Like the Jim Crow era. But it's something new. Something created by Dodd-Frank's enforcer, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. The law explicitly said they couldn't regulate car dealerships, and yet they are. And through a loophole so small, you could barely drive a Mini Cooper through it. They figured out they could throttle the dealerships through throttling the lenders who make the financing of your new ride possible. With their regulatory destination set in the GPS, the CFPB set out to conduct a study about racial discrimination in auto lending. A study that didn't find some races being charged higher interest rates. A study that didn't find some nationalities being charged higher interest rates. Well, what did it find? That some last names were being charged just a little bit more a month. That's right, last names? Here's Wall Street Journal columnist Holman Jenkins Jr.
Consumer Finance Protection Agency has to basically gin up its own estimates, so it uses last names and zip codes to assign racial classifications to people. Who knows how accurate this is? There's no peer review of this, and yet they find these tiny marginal differences, which come out to like 10 cents or 30 cents a month on a 66-month car loan.
So the hot-rodding regulators over at the CFPB took the last names of borrowers and their zip codes, and then they guessed whether or not they were a minority. So a guy named Williams in Queens was assumed to be black, but a guy named Williams in Malibu was assumed to be white. Talk about racist. This is their version of an educated guess, just not very educated. Bureaucrats in search of a problem, it's not very problematic. We're talking about 10 to 30 cents a month, if there's even 10 to 30 cents of truth in it at all. Let's keep in mind, the CFPB never determined there was any actual and intentional discrimination, which is important to the rule of law, or at least it used to be.
Laws exist that deal and make and prohibit overt intentional discrimination. Nobody is alleging that here. That's not what the CFPB is looking at.
But down comes their hammer anyway. And the lenders just settle with the CFPB to get the lawsuit off their table, even if they know they're innocent.
In December of 2013, the CFPB fined Ally Bank a combined $98 million as part of a settlement.
And then it happened again.
A federal investigation has been opened now against the American Honda Finance Corporation. Honda's financial services branch will pay out $24 million after accusations of racial discrimination. The government says Honda was overcharging customers for being black, Hispanic, and Asian.
One such lender sent the CFPB letter they got to Danny, which is exactly what the CFPB wanted.
As the banks, you know, put forth the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau letter in front of us and say, hey, you know, you got to comply with what we got to comply with. You know, and it's like, we're not a bank.
And threatening lenders and dealerships over last names is only half of what the CFPB is doing. But first, a little background on how the dealership business works. Now, as Danny would tell you, there are two things which affect what you pay for that new muscle car. The sticker price, and the price of the loan you get to buy the car. And to earn your business, dealerships want to be that one-stop shop, so they partner with lenders to offer you the best total package.
We don't want a customer to come into the dealership and say, hey, I want this car, that's the price, great. Then they got to go out and search for 10 different finance companies to get financing. It just gives the customer a more convenient way to get their financing on the vehicle, either through a manufacturing lender or a local lender that is hooked up with the dealership. It's easier for the customer, save them time, and obviously saves them money in most cases because they don't have to spend their time out looking for, you know, financing. You know, a lot of people take time off of work to make the second largest, you know, biggest investment in their lifetime, which is a car. And it does, it saves them time and money.
Because of the volume of business that a dealership does, they can often get you better rates than the folks off the street, and much more quickly. In 10 minutes, the dealer can put together 35 different offers, way more than the customer can get in a month, let alone a Saturday. And of course, this service isn't free for the dealership, and the dealership takes a small cut. It's called a dealer's reserve, and it's important.
I mean, that's how they keep their doors open, that's how they pay for the coffee, that's how they pay for the electricity, how they pay for their land, you know, all that stuff. So back in the 70s and early 80s, they had a spread, we call it. So hypothetically, if the bank gave the dealership a 15% buy rate, and it seems kind of high, but back then it was high. So roughly 15% interest rate, the dealer would turn around and sell it for hypothetically 18%. So that 3-point spread would allow the dealer to gain some reserve from the lender, profit in their finance reserve to help for their subsistence. So it really does help the dealerships to stay in business.
That 1-3% dealer reserve can provide as much as 20% of the total profit for a dealership. And it's just as important for us consumers as it is to the dealers. That's because if they need to beat another dealership's offer, but they've come down on the rock bottom of the sticker price of the car, they can still take a percent off of the reserve, which makes the overall cost of the car lower to us. And that can be a deal maker for a purchase. So how does the CFPB fit into all this? Kind of like a third wheel on a motorcycle.
In a compliance guidance bulletin, it simply told lenders they could avoid unintentional discrimination by taking one of two steps. One, eliminate dealer discretion and move to a flat fee. Or two, impose a series of controls on dealer discretion that are unworkable, virtually forcing the change to a flat fee system.
The CFPB solution would have finance sources compensate dealers with flat fees, mandatory flat fees, which means dealers would have no discretion to cut into their retail margin to earn consumers' business.
That was Paul Metre, the chief regulatory counsel for the National Automobile Dealers Association. The CFPB is proposing the flat fee so that there's no room for this problem of discrimination that they haven't proven to exist. This flat fee could be as low as $100, but if you're thinking that's a good thing, just put on the brakes a little bit.
That's a substantial amount of cutting into the dealer's profit. You know, contrary to popular belief, people think that, well, these dealers make big money, this and that, blah, blah, blah. Whereas a dealership, net-net, at the end of the month, barely make a single digit of profit in most cases.
More burdens could equal fewer dealers, and fewer dealers could equal fewer choices and higher prices. A future we might get stuck with whether dealers stay in business or not.
It will affect, you know, the dealer profit. So if the customer comes in and, you know, all of a sudden the dealership cannot profit from dealer reserve, obviously it's going to hinder the dealership to discount the front price of the vehicle, the actual pricing of the vehicle.
So the next time you go to that dealership, you might be negotiating not only with them, Uncle Sam may be at the table, laying down terms of his own and checking out your last name. Looking at the road, rushing under my wheel. For our American Stories, I'm Alex Cortez.
This is Lee Habib. Great job on that, Alex. And as always, great storytelling. Dodd-Frank, its impact on auto dealers, its impact on all of us. More after these messages. I don't know where I'm running now. I'm just running out.
o'clock on a Saturday. A regular crowd shuffles in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin.
This is Lee Habib, and you're listening to Billy Joel's Piano Man, and we're talking about the Piano Man himself, because on this day in history, on May 9th, in 1949, he was born to Howard and Rosalind Joel. And shortly after he was born, the family moved to a section of America's famous first suburb, Levittown, on Long Island. Although his father was an accomplished classical pianist, it was Joel's mom who pushed the young boy to study piano. He began playing at the age of four and showed an immediate aptitude for the instrument. And by the time he was 16, Joel was already a pro, having joined his third band before he could drive. It wasn't long before the artist, inspired by the Beatles' iconic Ed Sullivan Show performance, committed heart and soul to a life in music. He dropped out of high school to pursue a performing career, devoting himself to creating his first solo album with Columbia Records, Cold Spring Harbor, in 1971. It was a dud. And then came his second record, which we just played, Piano Man. And throughout the years, Joel has become known for his willingness to hold Q&A sessions with fans in settings across the globe. Here, Billy is asked about the story behind this iconic song. At Harvard University in 1994, here's his answer.
Yes, go ahead.
One of my favorite songs is Piano Man, and I was wondering what exactly the story is behind all of the lyrics, even though it's somewhat self-explanatory.
Okay. All of the characters in that song actually were real people. John at the bar was this guy named John, and he... and he was at the bar. There was... Davey was in the Navy. And probably still is, you know. And let's see, the waitress is practicing... The waitress is actually my first ex-wife. Well, I have to get used to first ex-wife and second ex-wife now. It's a new thing. But, let's not even get into that. Okay, so she was a cocktail waitress while I was... playing the piano at this place for a while. And let's see, what else happened in that song? And the waitress pranked upon things. As the businessmen slowly get... Businessmen actually got stoned in the place. They're sharing a drink. They call it better than drinking alone. Right, okay. A real estate novelist. Okay, good question. Paul is a real estate novelist. Paul was this guy who was a real estate broker, but he was writing the great American novel. And Paul was always saying, I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book. I'm gonna write the great American novel. You know, Paul, what do you do, like, you know, normally? Real estate. So that's a real estate novelist. Explains that. Let's see, what else? It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday. Okay. Regular crowd shuffles in. Old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin. Okay, a little bit of poetic license there. Wasn't really making love to his tonic and gin, because that could be pretty gross, actually. He says, "Son, can you play me Memory?" I'm not really sure what goes. "Sweet, sweet, no, complete, younger man's close." Okay, he didn't rhyme, actually, when he said it. But he essentially asked me, you know, can you sing an old song? Oh, la-da-da-da-dee-da-da. La-da-dee-da-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da. Self-explanatory. Sing a song, Piano Man, sing a song. Okay. Now, John the Bar is a friend of mine. Gets me my drinks for free. True. Free drinks. The gig sucked, but free drinks, hey, you know. And he's quick with a joke. He was always telling a joke. Light up your smoke. I used to smoke. I did this gig for 6 months, and people would come up to me and go, "You're too good for this place. what are you doing here? Why don't you... I can get you a record deal, because everybody in Hollywood is an entrepreneur. I can get you a deal. I can hook you up with a producer. I know a producer. Everybody in Los Angeles is a producer. I don't really know what a producer is. I thought it was somebody who produces. But produces what, you know? In Hollywood, they produce producing, you know? You know, I produce sweat, really. I mean, we're all producers. We produce bodily byproducts. You know, we're all producers. So, and they would say, what are you doing here? Man, what are you doing here? And I would say, oh, no, I love it here. I hate the music business. I want to be here. I was lying through my teeth, but I really didn't want to deal with another shyster, essentially, was what was going on. So it was a true story. And I thought, as I was playing in this gig, I said, I've got to write a song about this. I said, nobody's going to believe this. I got to write a song about this. And essentially, that's where the idea came from. So a very long answer to a very short question.
Yep, he had left New York to move to Los Angeles, and he was working at the Executive Room on Wilshire Boulevard. He was the lounge pianist under the pseudonym Bill Martin. And what a great story about where this all comes from. He takes a big risk and heads out west. When we come back, we're going to talk about his trip back east, because he moves back. Say Goodbye to Hollywood is what we'll come in with. Turnstiles and Forward to his first hit record, big hit record, The Stranger, The Life of Billy Joel. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages.
John at the bar is a friend of mine. He gets me my drinks for free. And he's quick with a joke or to light up your smoke. But there's some place that he'd rather be. He says, Bill, I believe this is killing me. As a smile ran away from his face. Well, I'm sure that I could be a movie star. If I could get out of this place. Oh, la, 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 di, di, da. La, la.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. That's Billy Joel, Say Goodbye to Hollywood. Turnstiles may be one of his finest records. And it's the record before his big, big breakout hit record. Up until then, Piano Man had been solid. Put him on the map for real music, folks. But what hit the charts, what really exploded his career, was a single. And it's a single you all know. And here's Billy Joel talking to Charlie Rose about the song Just the Way You Are.
I put out something like 4 albums on Columbia Records before I had a successful hit album. I don't think people can do that anymore. I don't think a record company will stay with an artist for that long.
Don't go changing. Try and please me. You never let me down before. Mm-hmm. Don't imagine you're too familiar. And I don't see you anymore. I would not leave you in times of trouble. Never could have come this far. Mm-hmm. I took the good times, I'll take the bad times, I take you just the way you are.
And that album went on to be number two. The next eight records, four were number one. And he's right. Today, no label would stick with an artist that long. And again, go to ouramericannetwork.org to listen to what we did with Amart Ertegun back when there were great label guys who stuck with artists and let them develop. And I believe today there would be no Billy Joel. Cold Spring Harbor would have come out, it would have flubbed, and that would have been it. See ya. Next. And so, what a smart move by Columbia Records. Joel stayed there his whole life in gratitude, I believe, as Springsteen did and so many of the artists did there because they had real A&R guys. And Joel went on to sell 150 million records. Crazy. 13 albums, 33 top 40 hits, 23 Grammy nominations, a Library of Congress Gershwin Prize, ASCAP Centennial Award, really crazy, and of course the Kennedy Center Awards, which we're going to get to later, because my goodness, what a spectacular presentation some of the artists did honoring Billy Joel. Well, there was an interview with Dick Cavett in 1990 where Billy Joel talked about his cure for writer's block and also his ability to dream in music.
My cure for writer's block is to dress like a writer, a sort of some kind of Chopin-esque outfit with a scarf, and something with some flair to it, some maybe even patches on the jacket, elbows. And,
he's not kidding, folks.
I'm serious about this.
Yeah.
And I go to a cafe or a brasserie or some place you'd see a famous writer, perhaps writing or pontificating or just the place where artists would be. And I sit at a table by myself. I order an espresso or a glass of wine. And I sit there and I look like a writer. And I have my notebook with me and I have my pen with the pen poised or behind the ear or sometimes just licking the tip of the pencil, which is bad for the tongue. But I've got all the, you know, to all appearances sake, I am in the throes of writing. And the waiter will tiptoe over. Well, can I get you anything else, Mr. Joe? No, I'm fine. And obviously he's writing, and he'll tell the other waiters, don't bother him, he's writing.
Mr. Joel is writing.
And then there'll be a buzz around the room, people expecting me to be writing. And I actually kind of kickstart the writing process by everyone expecting me to write, and me feeling like such a writer. I'll actually fool myself into starting the process.
Right.
But that's usually when I haven't been able to write lyrics. Mm-hmm. Music, I dream. Music constantly. I dream music. Some people dream scenarios. They dream, scenes and situations.
Yeah.
I don't dream like that. I dream in the abstract. I dream shapes. I dream colors and I dream music.
That's something. I mean, that tells you a lot right there. I mean, the guy dreams music. You're going to learn later in this hour that Joel, more often than not, comes up with the music first. And that's where the problem occurs, is how do I get the lyrics to fit the music? And that's actually how Elton John and Bernie Taupin, well, they do it actually in reverse. Bernie writes the words, and then Elton does the music. So go figure. Artists approach this in so many different ways. Here's Joel talking to Dick Cavett about how he hires other musicians to help him with the songwriting process, who are there to just make sure he isn't copying a song he had already heard that was written by someone else by accident.
I wrote a song and lyrics, and I brought it in and I showed the musicians, and I went, Anthony works in the grocery store, saving his pennies for somebody else. Isn't this great? And they went, that's Neil Sedaka's Laughing in the Rain. And I was crushed. I said, almost note for note. And I said, and I wrote lyrics. I spent the time and effort to even write lyrics to this thing. Well, I was damned if I was going to throw away a perfectly good set of lyrics. So I finished out the song with a complete different melody. But I'm glad I have musicians around to help me catch that. I even have a musicologist that I hire when I'm writing, just to catch, making sure that I don't do it.
You knew of the other song. It isn't that you'd never heard it. It just didn't click
in your
head.
You know what? I didn't even know that I knew the song.
Yeah.
And then somebody played me the record, and maybe I'd heard it once. The other night it occurred to me, I may start up a whole nest of hornets here, but there is a soundtrack to the movie called Cinema Paradiso. Mm-hmm. Great soundtrack. But there's one part where it goes, And it starts just like, I've never been in love before, but all at once. And I said, wait a minute, where have I heard this? It happens all the time. Yeah. I think I've even found Beethoven lifting Mozart. But the intention was different, and he didn't follow through on it. Of course, I don't know if their lawyers talk to each other anymore.
Only in Vienna.
Well, they're decomposing right now anyway.
And they are. But it's been happening through the centuries. Artists lifting, and no, rim shot. Artists stealing from one another without knowing they're stealing. Highest compliment in some odd ways. And here's Billy Joel talking to Dick Cavett about his songwriting process, saying that the minute you try to write a hit song deliberately, you've actually defeated the songwriting process itself.
I've never sat down and said, I'm going to write a hit. It would be like writing a beer commercial. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I write what I want to hear. I write what I want to do. And I put it on an album. And I write it in tandem and in conjunction with a whole bunch of other songs. Now, I give that album to the record company. And the record company says, we want to put this out as a single. I say, well, go ahead. I wouldn't know a hit single if it came and smacked me in the face. But I think what happens is people hear a particular recording out of context with the other songs that are around it and assume, oh, he just wrote this one song just to be a hit record. And that's not what happens. Not with me, at any rate. I wish sometimes I could sit down and write a hit record, to be perfectly honest, to shut a lot of people up.
If you could do that and also produce the formula for how to write one, you would have a best-selling.
Yeah, but I think the minute you've tried to write a hit, you've defeated the songwriting process itself.
It's like setting out to make a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Thwarts itself.
That's right.
So here's the guy who wrote hit after hit after hit after hit. And his advice to folks who are trying to write hits, don't try to write a hit. And by the way, he always wanted to be a teacher, felt obligated. And thus, you're going to be hearing, you already heard a clip of a Q&A at Harvard in 1990-something. You'll hear in the next segment a Q&A about how the song Lullaby came to be. Because in the end, he's always touring around the country periodically with just a keyboard in smaller venues at colleges mostly, talking to young people who all still know and love his music. And they show up at his concerts all the time, explaining how he does what he does and trying to teach the next generation about what it takes to do what he does, the craft of songwriting and singing and performing. This is Lee Habib, the life of Billy Joel, for the hour, born on this day in history, and this day in history always brought to you by Hillsdale College. Go to hillsdale.edu to see their great, great online courses. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, the life of Billy Joel being celebrated this day in history, brought to you by Hillsdale College, the best place in this country to learn about all the finer things in life, from the arts to the humanities and to the political formations of this great country. And by the way, what you'd learn at Hillsdale is that this patent right in the first article of the Constitution, our founders, guys like Benjamin Franklin, were thinking about, well, the people like Billy Joel down the road, because Billy owns his publishing. And my goodness, what would the world be like if he didn't? Where would the artistic and this creativity come from if the writer couldn't own his work? And we've learned that over and over again as we celebrated the life of Sinatra and those songwriters. And this is one of the greats, Billy Joel, born on this day in history. And, you know, at a time when guitars were driving everything in music, well, this guy was playing the keyboards. And in this clip from 1977, which we dug up, a young Billy Joel talks about comparisons between that other guy who was famous at the keyboard, Elton John, and another guy who was just highly regarded behind the keyboard, very different stylist, Leon Russell. Let's hear from Billy.
Elton really broke the piano pop barrier, and he became the definitive piano rock artist. And anybody who became known after him was compared to Elton John. I don't play the same way he does. Elton's style is very rhythmic, you know. Like that. Or like Leon Russell is another guy he used to get comparisons to. And he's more like gospel, you know. All right, woo, you know. And my style is probably, it's more five finger, more movement stuff. I took a while for people to get away from using the Elton John comparison. I think it's pretty much died down at this point. Mm. I hope so. Please.
Please.
Hey.
Give me a break.
Give me a break.
And just a New York kid. And again, he moves out to Los Angeles. Then he comes back to New York. And by the way, if you'd ever seen him perform, Seeing the Lights Go Out on Broadway after 9/11, I mean, the lyrics were eerie, and it was a really tough song for him to perform at Madison Square Garden, where, by the way, his consecutive number of shows, 12 in a row, was a record, and his number is retired at Madison Square Garden. The only non-athlete who has a number hanging from the rafters. Pretty remarkable on the performance level. Let's get back to the songwriting, because I told you that he does these Q&As, and he did one at the University of Pennsylvania. And there was a fantastic moment where towards the end, Billy took questions from the audience, and a woman asked him how her favorite song, and a young woman, easily 25 to 30 years younger than Billy, she wanted to know about her favorite song, Lullaby, and how it came to be. And here's Billy Joel explaining it.
All right, so I had this melody. Which is how I write songs. I wrote the music first. She goes, Daddy, what happens when you die? So I said, oh, man. Whew. Okay. And I told her what I really believed. And what I really believe is what happens when you die is you go into other people's hearts. That you never really go away. You go into the rest of the people that you knew, you go into the rest of their lives. They take them with you. So, but also this was during a time when her mom and I were splitting up. So this was like a double-pronged thing, like, Daddy, you're going to leave me. And I said, I'll never leave you. I will never leave you. I'll never go away. I will never, never, ever leave you. So it was a tough answer, you know, in both respects. So I'm trying to remember when I was writing it.
So he struggles a little bit more, and he's actually tearing up. You can tell this is a really hard song for him to sing, and this is the thing about music in the end and a story. And think about this. He's really trying to solve a problem. That's what brings him to this song. So let's go a little bit further down in this masterclass. Here's Billy Joel again.
Questions for another day. I think I know what you've been asking me. I think you know what I've been trying to say. I promised I would never leave you, and you should always know where far away.
And there you have it, Billy Joel answering his little girl's question with a song. He continues through the second verse, and as he gets through the end, he has almost a breakdown. He starts to cry. He starts to pull away from the microphone. It's so emotional. It's so intimate. He never gives this explanation of the song when he's at Madison Square Garden. But here it's just him, a keyboard, and a couple of thousand people. Well, he comes back to the keyboards and shares the stunning final verse of this song again for his little girl.
Good night, my angel. Now it's time to dream. And dream how wonderful your life will be. Someday your child may cry, and if you sing this lullaby, then in your heart there will always be a part of me. Someday we'll all be gone, but lullabies go on and on. They never die, that's how you and I will be.
And there you have it, a master teacher, a master storyteller. Well, this is one of my favorites. It's one of also Jesse's musician heroes' favorites. And so let's listen to Billy tell another great story. This is one of the most beautiful compositions and one of my favorites and my wife's as well.
In every heart there is a sanctuary safe and strong to heal the wounds from lovers past until a new one comes along. I spoke to you in cautious tones. You answered me with no pretense. And still I feel I said too much. My silence is my self-defense.
We'll be back with more from Billy Joel. This day in history, the great musician and writer was born. More after this.
It seems I only felt the thorns. And so
like to get away, take a holiday from the neighborhood, hop a flight to Miami Beach or to Hollywood. But I'm taking a Greyhound on the Hudson River line. I'm in a New York state of mind.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories for the Hour, the life of Billy Joel, born on this day in history, brought to you, as always, by Hillsdale College, a great institution, a great place for higher learning, where you study all the finer and more beautiful things in life. In 2013, Billy Joel was honored at the Kennedy Center, the highest award you can get in the arts. To introduce him, Tony Bennett.
We came of age with the legacy of the great American songbook created by George Gershwin, Jerome Kern, the great Cole Porter, and interpreted by Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole, and then myself. The whole world loves these songs, but times change, and there was an opening for another songbook. Enter Billy Joel. Billy's an exciting performer who can move and electrify audiences. He does it singing the songs of Billy Joel. Great songs on subjects from love to war, from triumph and to loss, and stories about ordinary people with extraordinary emotions. And he puts them to tunes that you can't get out of your head. What a thrill it was for me to perform with Billy in front of 110,000 of our fellow New Yorkers at Shea Stadium singing his New York State of Mind. Billy Joel. Billy Joel is no less than a poet, a performer, a philosopher, and today's American songbook.
Wow. Passing the torch along and accepting it. And out came the performances. First, that great crooner, Don Henley.
Ladies and gentlemen, Don Henley.
She's got a way about her. Don't know what it is. Got a way of pleasing. I don't know why it is. It doesn't have to be a reason.
And coming up next, an unlikely country artist to sing Billy Joel's Allentown.
Ladies and gentlemen, Garth Brooks.
And Garth knocked it out of the park. In fact, the comment section's underneath the video, and go and search it on YouTube and just put in Billy Joel and put in the Kennedy Center, and you're going to see, I don't like Garth Brooks, but, and here's why. This is Garth performing Goodnight Saigon. Take a listen.
Cameras to shoot the landscape.
the audience is going crazy because a bunch of Vietnam veterans came out and sang that song. And Joel had to fight back the tears. I think Garth connected with his song because Joel was writing about his people. Out-of-work miners. Guys not lucky enough to get a deferment from the draft. The working class people is what Billy always wrote about and with whom he connected the most. And now we're going to set up, as we leave this hour, celebrating the life of Billy Joel with, I think, what may be his very best composition, Downeaster Alexa. Not a hit, but boy, when he plays it in concert, it stops the show. And the song is about the fishermen of Long Island being driven from their homes. And it's a song he knows well because he is a Long Islander. But it's a song we all know. And he's writing about people who are just struggling to get along in this modern economy. Some are doing great and some aren't doing as well. And Billy always, as a writer, is always rooting for the underdog, always writing about the underdog and doing it with emotion and with great power. Let's take a listen to this great composition. The hour, the life of Billy Joel, born on Long Island, writing about Long Island. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib.
Make a living.